You said the final is going to just be on Hume and Kant?
No. The final is going to include Locke and Descartes, as I said a couple of days ago when I was saying that I wanted to make it easier by giving you some questions that you've already seen. So there'll be questions either from, you know, from the midterm or from one of the quizzes. And I've looked through them and you've seen these questions. So the questions on, there'll be questions on Locke and Hume. I mean Locke and Descartes, but there'll be very few on Descartes, but you know, there'll be several on Locke which are sort of connected up with the kinds of questions that you have, you would expect to have on Hume. Okay. I will say that as you'll discover, the final exam question is on Hume. And it's on the thing we spent the most time on since we took the midterm. Hume's critique of the idea of a causal relationship, which I pampered in so many different ways that even I am sick of talking about it. But I'm sure that you have ample resources. You have a 2-page handout on this. So, and we've talked about it frequently in class. So.
Do you have any extras of that handout?
All the handouts are available online.
Yeah, that one, I think it was like 2 pages front and back.
That one is available.
It doesn't have the front and back.
The one online is both sides. I assure you, because I printed the one I gave out in class from the one that's online. So check it out, because it's there. So I got some batteries, so this part will be recorded, because so little, like only 5 minutes was recorded, what I said before. However, what I went into great detail about in the first hour was actually just carefully trying to explain to you what the idea of an intuition is and where the form of intuition comes from. Okay? And in the Transcendental Aesthetic, Kant tries to go through the origins of the concepts of space and time, and then their true origins, which he thinks he's discovered, lie in intuition. They are special features of all intuitions, whether inner intuitions, inner affections, or outer affections, which are one and all sense perceptions. So if it's a sense perception, it's an outer affection. If it is an inner affection, it could be also a sense perception, because Kant says that when you are aware, because remember when we were talking about simple ideas of sensation and then a simple idea of reflection on the midterm, most of you gave me some obvious simple sensation, like the idea of red, of red, a patch of red, you know, the simple idea of the color red. And then many of you gave me as an example of a simple idea of reflection, thinking about the first, which is exactly right. Okay? So all inner affections, all ideas of reflection, at least, can be generated simply by taking note of what we are perceiving when we are having a sense perception. And when you take note of that, that is located only in time, not in space. Your memory of what you saw is in your mind. It's not out there. What you saw was out there, right? You saw the desk, you saw your grandmother. But your memory of that is not an affection which is presented to you in space. Okay? Your memory is not, you don't go back to where you saw your grandmother to remember. Right? So all sense perceptions have this part of them, which is the part that is simply the fact that it is something occurring in your mind. And insofar as you notice them in that respect, you are treating your sense perceptions as inner affections, as states of your own mind. And as such, they only have the form of time. Right? Okay?
Sometimes you go back, when I lose my keys.
Yes. Sure, because now you're trying to, but now what you're doing is using your memory to try to locate yourself in the space of experience. Oh, yeah. And that space, and this is good, Casey, because there's always something useful because Kant's theory is so comprehensive, and it's hard to wrap your head around it and see it from all angles. There are different concepts of space. There's the concept of the space in which our planet resides, and that is not the what Kant means by the pure intuition of space. Okay. The space the world exists in is empirical space. It's the space of experience, right? That's actual space in which there are actual sensations oriented in that space, okay? And without actual sensations, we wouldn't know about that space, right? That space is out there. The pure intuition of space is nowhere at all. If it's in anything, it's only metaphorically, since in is a spatial concept as we use it frequently. Although we can abstract it and say that, you know, inside the number four, there is the number three and two and one, right? Those are in four, right? But not spatially in. And the concept of the pure intuition of space is in the mind, but it's not, right? It's not in my head. It's not in yours, and it's not where, you know, you last, where you were when you thought. Okay. So what I wanted to do now is to talk about the strategy of the transcendental aesthetic and explain how Kant establishes that there are some synthetic a priori judgments by showing us that space and time are what I've been saying they are today, the pure forms of outer and inner sense, respectively. He wants to show that space and time are nothing more than modes of presentation for intuitions containing sensation. That doctrine, that space and time are intuitions, forms of intuition, is the doctrine of transcendental idealism. Let me explain why he calls it that. It's idealism, it's an idealist thesis because it attributes something ascribed to the world of perception which arises due to something originating in the mind itself. Idealism is broadly the claim that reality consists of ideas or is mental, right? And Kant has announced at the beginning of the Critique of Pure Reason that he is going to solve all of philosophy's major problems, including Hume's problem about the existence of the external world, problem about the right to use the idea of a causal relationship in considering relations among objects of our perception, and so on. He's going to solve all these problems by proceeding to limit metaphysics to the world of possible perception. So in doing so, he's already announcing that his is going to be an idealist philosophy of some kind. The world we're going to know is a world of perception, of possible perception. If something is not a possible perception, it can't exist in our world, and such that we can know about it. It might exist there, but it wouldn't be a possible perception, so we wouldn't be able to learn anything about it. So it's idealist for that reason. It's transcendental because this thesis depends on looking into the conditions of the possibility of the spatial and temporal ordering of our sensations, of our conscious sensations, which is, that is, of our perceptions. And when we look into that, we discover that the origins of that form lie in something about the mind's own operation. And Kant defines transcendental as investigations into things pertaining to or explained by the very nature and operations of the faculties of the mind itself. So transcendental questions are not questions about what lies. It's not transcendent in the sense of being lying outside the world or being, you know, like God is transcendental, as some people would put it. He doesn't mean it in the sense of transcendent. He means a transcendental concept is a concept that you acquire by means of something about the mind's own activity and its own structure, its own powers. Something that is a concept which you wouldn't have if you didn't have a mind with the kind of faculties you do. It's something brought to the mental content by the mind itself. Thus, any idea which is properly innate would be explained by means of a transcendental analysis. It would be a transcendental concept, and thus would be an a priori concept in some sense. Okay. I think somewhere in here I say something. A judgment concept or intuition, this is on your glossary, is transcendental when it is derived from one of the innate cognitive faculties. A belief or idea is empirical when its content begins in, refers to, and is derived from sensory experiences. Okay. So the thesis that space and time are pure forms of intuition, without which sense perception would be impossible, is a transcendental thesis because it describes space and time and the spatio-temporal ordering of our perceptions. It describes the cause of those to an action of the mind itself, and denies that space and time are anything independent of the form of what I just said, forms of intuition. So insofar as space, as you might think of space and time as existing mind independently and independent of any particular perception, space and time are not real. They don't exist. Space and time are nothing more than a mode of presentation for sensations as you experience them. Okay? So that's transcendental idealism. Now, can we prove that transcendental idealism is the case? That's the burden of both sections of the transcendental aesthetic. The chief burden is to show you that space and time really are forms of intuition imposed on sensation by the mind as a price for making sensations conscious for a mind like ours. They originate in the transcendental imagination, processing what is given to the mind. And the part that's given to the mind is the part I have on the chart here, right? The sensations. That's what is given to your mind, sensations. And until you have any of those, your mind is empty. But you can't be conscious of these inputs until they are ordered in space and time. And the price for making them conscious is that they have this order, because if we didn't order them in space and time, if we didn't have the capacity to do that with them, they would all pile in on top of each other, and it would be, and our sensory experience would be nothing like it is, just, you know, where discrete sensations can be kept apart and distinguished from each other. We'd have all our sensations at once, piled all together. And that's too much for a mind like ours, which is one possible answer to the question, why is our mind structured the way it is? Why does it impart spatial and temporal order to all the sensations that are given to it? Okay. He also conducts some experiments, right? And one of his experiments is to show what I already did to you, that if space and time were legitimate empirical concepts rather than some kind of a priori concept, you would be able to perceive them. And the thought experiments I gave to you yesterday, and the day before, where I asked you to consider what's left over if you remove all the sensations in your visual field, the answer is nothing at all. Not an empty container that is space. There's nothing left. There's nothing you can perceive that's left. But nonetheless, you think that that space has something to do with something you ascribe to your sensations. But it's apparently not a prop. It's better to think of those as something given to sensations, right? Since you don't perceive them, it violates the empiricist thesis about the origin of all truly empirical ideas. That it's not something that you can trace back to an impression of sensation, remember? This is just like Locke's attack on the concept of substance, because you couldn't... any idea pertaining to the world of perceptions that you could trace back to an idea of sensation becomes a property or relation of that object, and therefore can't play the role of substance, which is that in which the properties reside, right? So you can't have any ideas of sensation corresponding to the idea of substance. Therefore, the idea is illegitimate as applied to the world of perception. Similarly, the idea of a necessary connection in Hume and the idea of substance are both illegitimate. And now we see Kant applying the same kind of empiricist critique to the idea of space and the idea of time, and simply revealing to us the conundrum that we are sure that our experience comes in time, but when we go looking for it, we don't find anything at all. And believe me, Kant is not the first to have noticed this. There's always been something puzzling about time. And we use all these metaphors to try to get a hold of it, of how time seems. Because time is strangely diaphanous. It's even worse than diaphanous. It's so diaphanous that you can't detect it at all. You can only detect it in the relations among things that apparently have spatial relation, temporal relations to each other. And this actually puzzled Einstein, and eventually he concluded that the only time that was useful for doing physics was clock time. And it turns out that clock time is only relative to a particular clock. And if you have two different frames of reference, systems of movement, right? Then clock time there is no universal clock. There is only clock time relative to a frame of reference. Okay, but the idea of time is sort of the idea of something that stands behind all particular clocks, right? It's the universal clock. But unfortunately, we have nothing in experience that can underwrite that, other than the fact that we have an inexplicable ability to keep track of our experiences in terms of their temporal relations. So there must be something. So Kant comes to the conclusion that both... I'm not going to ask you to give any of the arguments for what it is, how Kant, you know, establishes that space and time are the pure form of intuition. You just need to know that he does establish that. And as a result, establishes that transcendental idealism is true. Now he has one synthetic a priori judgment that he can actually make and justify, which is the judgment that space and time are the pure forms of inner and outer sense respectively, or outer and inner sense respectively. And that's because this is a judgment which appeals, it's a priori because it is not true on the basis of any particular perception, but true of all perceptions as the condition of the possibility of any perception. And it's synthetic because it's established by means of a synthesis in the manifold of intuition. And as forms of the manifold, the sensations are synthesized, brought together in a manifold according to the form of space and time. And thus, that makes space and time synthetic. And the judgment that they're the forms of intuition, therefore, synthetic judgments. Space is the pure form of outer intuition because it is the condition of the possibility of the synthesis of the manifold of outer intuition. That makes it a synthetic feature of perception and makes the judgment that that's true a synthetic judgment, because it could have been otherwise. You have to bring the concept of spatial relations together with the concept of a manifold and the concept of of the ordering of that manifold according to space. And all those aren't concepts that belong together. They have to be shown to be together by showing that the manifold of sensation presupposes the form of space. And it's that fact, the arguments to show that, that reveal to us the synthesis that confirms the truth of transcendental idealism. Then Kant goes ahead, having proved the transcendental ideality of space and time, he then goes on to try to, you might say, reinforce this by first showing that mathematical propositions are synthetic, and then showing that the only way we can justify mathematical propositions, given that they're synthetic, is by means of the pure intuitions of space and time. Thus, he shows that he takes something you take to be true, that the truths of mathematics are universal and necessary a priori, and shows that you can't justify that claim unless you have access to the pure intuition of space, in the case of geometry, and the pure intuition of time, in the case of arithmetic. So, what I want to say, are any of you absolutely forced to leave immediately?
I have to.
You have to, okay. Anyone who doesn't have to leave immediately, I suggest that you stick around. The tape will be available for those who have to leave. And I have about 5 more minutes of things to say that I'd like to get in today, if you don't mind. Is that all right? And it'll just be available to any of those who don't make it by download later. Okay. On that lectures and handouts page under recordings. Okay? So the final exam is going to be available to everyone from the courses page, which is just the page that has Philosophy 310 on it in the middle, in a banner. And then a little blurb about how to get the Acrobat Reader. Okay, for the different platforms. And between those two, there will be a link that says final exam can be downloaded here. Okay? So, I love these particular arguments so much that I wanted to try to get them out today if we had a chance. First of all, here's something that's true. Each of these hands takes a spatial description that can be laid out in terms of Euclidean geometry. They're three-dimensional shapes, right? But they're not equal exactly, right? One is left and the other is right. How can I show that they're not equal? How can I show that the left and the right orientation present different, the concept of my right hand is a different concept than the concept of my left hand? If all we do is think of the internal relations among the points on the, you might say, think of these, my hands as gloves, with gloves on. So think of the mathematical description of the glove in terms of, you know, the relationship between all the points on the perimeter of the glove and all the other points. You can do that. And if you do, they're identical. They're the same concept. Yet that's wrong. See? Right? I can turn it this way, but it's not the same as, right? It's still the underside of the one, you know, right? I can't make them coincide by just considering their perimeter and the relations from the perimeter, you know, all the perimeter points to each other. So how am I going to display that? That's a truth of geometry that I ought to be able to capture. The difference between a left hand and a right hand in three-dimensional terms. Well, the answer is I have to be able to display them in space. If I can display them in space, I can show the orientation. Because one of the things that comes with space is left, right, up, and down. If I can't display them in space, I can't reveal the difference between them. So it just turns out that space is necessary to this geometric judgment. Right? The pure intuition of space allows me to represent that idea. If I don't have access to it, I can't prove that this is true. So we have two steps here. One is that here's a judgment of geometry, which is not an analytic truth. These are not equal, but they seem analytically, you can't establish that using only the concepts of geometry without space as a mode of presentation for the concepts. So just with concepts alone, Euclidean geometry is powerless to explain the difference between these two shapes. So they're conceptually identical from the point of view of geometry. And yet they aren't identical. And geometry is not about the concepts, it's about objects in space, isn't it? And their orientation. Okay, that's the first thing. So that shows that it's a synthetic judgment, and the synthetic judgment can't be shown to be true without presenting the concept of my left hand and the concept of my right hand in space. So I actually need to represent, and the fact that my two hands, by the way, in case you might have thought that, well, here's a way to prove it, you know, run over to the math department. I have a proof that indiscernible counterpart shapes are nonetheless counterparts and not identicals. And they'll all laugh at you. You have to be able to represent this universally and necessarily, which means without relying on any particular empirical intuition, without showing your hands and asking someone to look at them. That's just this object. What you need is to represent these shapes without sensations, and then you know that any possible hand in any possible visual space would be the counterpart, but the non-identical counterpart of its opposite. Left hand would be the non-identical counterpart of the right hand. So any possible left hand is a non-identical counterpart to any possible right hand, however exact their size and shape is exactly similar otherwise. Yeah.
Is that many in one or one in many?
Well, this is a many in one. All intuitions are many in one because they're presented at once. It wouldn't do any good for me to represent, you know, part of this hand and then later represent another part. They need to be represented at once to show that it's just the fact that this shape, but in a pure manifold, show that no matter what hands get represented in space, what is true of these two ideal hands will be true of those as well. And now we have a justification that we didn't have if we thought geometry was analytic. Okay. Now, there's another one. The other argument is that arithmetic is synthetic. Arithmetic is synthetic because 7 plus 5 equals 12 is not an analytic judgment. If you analyze the concept of 12, lots of concepts come out of it. Unfortunately, only some of them are 7 plus 5. Here are some others. 5 plus 7, different order. 4 plus 8, 8 plus 4, 7 plus 5, 5 plus 7. You see where we're going here, right? And just so you see how bad it gets, there's also 2 times 6, 6 times 2, 12 divided by 1. One twelfth multiplied by 144. Are you getting me? If you analyze this concept, if you think analytic judgments are true because the predicate concept is contained in the subject concept, let's suppose that this is the subject concept, right? And this is the predicate. So this is the subject, this is the predicate. If you analyze this, this is something that will get you to 12. But the concept of 12 doesn't even plausibly have the concept of an operation in it at all, let alone many different numbers and which you can combine by operations. The concept of 12 doesn't contain the concept of division and multiplication and subtraction and division. That's bizarre.
So So
but it would need to if you thought it was an analytic judgment.
So they can only be holes then?
Well, it's not that they're holes, it's just that the very idea that 12, that this judgment is analytic. The concepts, this is not to say that the concepts are holes. It's to say that the concept of 12 doesn't seem to contain the concept of a mathematical operation. And if to be an analytic judgment, you have to be able to show that the predicate concepts are contained in the subject, there's something contained in these concepts which is missing here. So he says it's better to think of this kind of judgment as a synthetic judgment, as basically the following. If I bring 7 and 5 together by addition, the result is 12. But that's a judgment that's true by a synthesis. I demonstrate that I can synthesize, and by the way, all of these others are syntheses, right? These are all combinations of concepts brought together by a synthesis. In this case, it's a synthesis of judgment, right? But in fact, in order to get to the synthesis of judgment, we have to first be able to represent that synthesis in a manifold, in a perceptual manifold. And the only way now we're to the second part. If you accepted that arithmetic 7 plus 5 equals 12 is a synthetic judgment, you can't show that it's true unless you can represent everything we asserted here in a synthesis in a manifold, and preferably a pure manifold so that it's universally necessary. Well, how do you do that? Kant's answer is, if you presuppose the pure intuition of time, you can represent the synthesis of 7 moments of time and 5 moments of time brought together, and when you do that, if you take 7 moments of time and 5 moments of time and add them together in one manifold and then count them, you find that you get 12, thus proving that 7 plus 5 equals 12. And that's it, you guys. Sorry.